Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program. Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these messages with you across the prison walls. This week on KiteLine, we begin looking at the intersection of borders, documentation, and incarceration. The recent political climate in the U.S. has brought the issues facing undocumented immigrants to the forefront of many community organizing efforts. As we've mentioned in previous episodes, here in Bloomington, there's already been a demand submitted to the Indiana University Administration to declare IU a sanctuary campus in solidarity with the National Movimiento Cosecha. In this episode, we will learn about the background of U.S. immigration policy and how immigrant detention has become such a racialized institution. We also have an opportunity to hear from local artists and activists who have been organizing for immigrants' rights. But first, here's some prison-related news.
Earlier this year, prisoners held in the Wallace Pack facility in Texas won a lawsuit forcing administrators to provide clean water after demonstrating in court that they were being forced to drink arsenic-contaminated water. Now, the fight against toxic prisons in Texas has spread to the Eastern Unit, where prisoners are complaining about a sulfur-like smell. Keith Malik Washington was transferred to a facility due to repression following the September 9th strike along with 43 other men and was shocked by the physical condition of the prison. Besides the water contamination, prisoners have reported lead paint, black mold, and are infested with roaches. Washington describes the conditions there as, quote, cruel and unusual. The complaint he has filed through outside supporters appears to be the first step of a long struggle. Recently, we reported that the New Jersey legislature had voted to limit the use of solitary confinement in the state. The legislature had voted to halt isolating prisoners for as long as 23 hours a day for months or years after finding that isolation was abusive and made it harder for inmates to return to their communities. The bill would have prevented placing juvenile, pregnant, elderly, mentally ill, and LGBTQ prisoners in solitary confinement. We now have an update on that story. On December 5th, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie vetoed the bill, calling it, quote, partisan and juvenile, unquote. The New Jersey Department of Corrections previously issued data demonstrating that the use of solitary confinement was declining in the state. In recent years, over 10 states and President Obama have moved to decrease the use of solitary. Research has demonstrated that the practice can induce ill effects, including mental illness, heart palpitations, violent fantasies, and self-mutilation.
Democracy Now! Reports that over the weekend, federal authorities in Texas reportedly released nearly 500 women and children from the nation's two largest family detention centers. Legal advocates say most families were released without travel plans, and volunteers worked with a local church to open shelter space early Saturday morning. The move followed a ruling Friday by a Texas judge that bars the state's Department of Family and Protective Services from issuing child care licenses to family detention centers. Advocates say conditions at the facilities are equivalent to prisons. The judgment effectively invalidates the licenses now used to operate the facilities, which are owned by GEO and CoreCivic, formerly known as Corrections Corporation of America. Human rights groups have called on the Obama administration to end the practice of detaining families before the end of his administration.
The maximum security F house at the Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois, was a roundhouse in which the watchtower is surrounded by a circle of four tiers of cells. Stateville is the only prison in this country to contain a roundhouse. A Chicago watchdog group deemed the roundhouse unfit for human habitation. The Illinois Department of Corrections has officially closed the roundhouse and moved out the 348 male inmates. State prison officials moved out the last 36 roundhouse inmates on November 30th. The inmates supposedly posed a threat to the staff or other prisoners. The roundhouse was one of the state's oldest and most expensive prison facilities. The move to close the roundhouse is part of the Illinois governor's plan to reform the state's criminal justice system. The plan includes reopening a closed prison in Murfreesboro as a minimum security complex, focusing on preparing inmates for transitioning back into the community. Some 10 years ago, at the age of 20, Tonaldo Hall, an African-American Oklahoma woman, went to prison for 30 years for failing to protect her children from abuse. Though her boyfriend, Robert Braxton, was charged with four counts of child abuse, he changed his plea at trial and received a reduction of his sentence to 10 years, 2 years in prison and 8 years of probation. He received credit for time served and was freed the day he pled. Braxton treated both Hall and her children violently. According to law enforcement officials, he broke the ribs and femur of the couple's 3-month-old daughter and choked, punched, and grabbed Hall around the neck several times. Hall wasn't convicted of abusing her children, but she was sentenced for failing to protect them because she permitted Braxton to watch them and didn't report the abuse in a timely fashion. She had no prior criminal record.
Caitlin has just received an update about Brescia Meadows, the 15-year-old survivor of domestic violence who has been charged with killing her abusive father. A letter from support person Marcia Dinkins reads, "Yesterday, an official from the Trumbull County Prosecutor's Office stated that Brescia will not be charged as an adult. We are glad to hear that Brescia will not be subject to trial as an adult that could potentially see her in prison. While we are glad that Brescia will not be facing life in prison, we are still committed to seeing Brescia freed from jail entirely and secure support for victims of domestic violence so that no child is forced to endure what Brescia Meadows has. Will you please continue to spread the word? Together we can ensure that Brescia Meadows isn't charged at all and that victims of domestic violence begin to get the support they need." The following has been excerpted from an essay titled "Deportability and the Carceral State," written by Professor Tori Hester and published in the Journal of American History. In it, Hester outlines the recent history of U.S. immigration policy and enforcement and explains how immigrant detention has become such a large contributor to mass incarceration.
Unlawfully entering the United States after deportation is a felony. Remaining in the United States after the expiration of a visa is also a felony. Passing a bad check when undocumented is an aggravated felony. Each punishable by at least 1 year in prison, these immigration-related crimes today constitute the leading cause of imprisonment in the federal penal system. Drug offenders, in other words, no longer constitute the majority of federal prisoners. Over the past decade, immigration offenders have consistently equaled or outnumbered drug offenders in the federal penal system, although the margin is relatively slight. In 2011, for example, drug offenders made up 29.1% of all federal convictions compared to immigration offenders who represented 34.9% of all convictions. Together, however, immigration and drug offenders were the majority of all prisoners in the federal penal system, making both immigration control and the war on drugs cornerstones of the carceral state. As the work of Maine Guy and Kelly Little Hernandez has made clear, the history of deportation from the United States is largely a history of race. From the passage of federal legislation to everyday immigration law enforcement, race has deeply influenced who is defined and policed as deportable. During the 1920s, however, Congress greatly expanded deportability and established the U.S. border control. By the end of the decade, immigration authorities were deporting tens and then hundreds of thousands of people each year. Congress created all new deportable categories in the 1920s when it developed a new immigration system designed to halt large-scale immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, as well as a small immigration stream from Asia. Under the new national origin system, immigrants were required to obtain visas and pay fees. Each nation in the Eastern Hemisphere was assigned a visa quota of no fewer than 100 persons, yet 70% of the total, around 110,000 visas, went to England, Ireland, and Germany. Congress based the distribution of visas according to a formula rigged to discriminate against people from Southern and Eastern Europe. The new national origin systems also extended bans on Asian immigration, which by 1917 included Chinese migrants and almost all other Asians. In 1924, Congress closed off the only remaining legal immigration stream out of Asia, one from Japan. The new laws made much of the immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe and all of Asia unlawful. People who migrated anyway, those who came in violation of immigration law, were deportable. By the 1930s, the U.S. Border Patrol was prioritizing the deportation of Mexicans, and in the process, they built up a capacity to deport hundreds of thousands of people annually. The percentage of Mexicans as a total of persons deported increased from just under 29% in 1931 to over 52% in 1943. Just 2 years later, the figure was 96%. In a publicized campaign in 1954 known as Operation Wetback, the proportion of Mexicans of the total of all deportations increased more than ever to 96%. In that year, the U.S. government removed 1,022,267 Mexicans, while deporting only 5,979 other immigrants in total, 3,345 of whom were Canadians. Both the expansion of the legal basis for the deportation of low-wage Mexican workers and the enforcement priority in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands exacerbated racial inequality in the Southwest. Mexican immigrants before this expansion of deportability faced a broad spectrum of racial discrimination, from a dual-wage system that paid ethnic Mexicans less than white workers, to racist biological and cultural stereotypes, to segregated and unequal education. After the expansion, deportable Mexicans had few rights and could be paid even lower wages, even in employment sectors where they were in high demand. Employers and white Americans more generally, moreover, did not regularly distinguish between legal and illegal Mexican migrants or even U.S. citizens of Mexican heritage. The requirements of fees and documents that created systemic deportability for people from Mexico did not enshrine racism into law, as did Chinese exclusion, but Border Patrol practices systemically fostered racial subordination. Immigration enforcement, as the historian Kelly Little Hernandez puts it, transformed the legal and illegal divide into a problem of race. Thus, deportability deepened the racialization of Mexicans and Mexican Americans alike. Policymakers and employers worked to create a legal mechanism to make it easier for Mexican immigrants to immigrate lawfully. They established a new subcategory of immigrant in U.S. policy, the guest worker. The Bracero program, an all-Mexican program, ran from 1943 to 1964, and the H-2 program, which drew heavily from Jamaica, ran from 1943 to 1986. Guest workers in these programs faced deportation if they did not meet the terms of their employment, and after the term of their employment, they had to return to their country of origin or face deportation. While guest worker programs often applied to more than one group, most fulfilled labor demands in the American Southwest and facilitated patterns of migration out of Mexico. Between 1952 and 1961, for example, 3,557,076 agricultural guest laborers entered the United States. Over 3.4 million, around 95%, came from Mexico. The second largest group, 81,050, came from the British West Indies, especially Jamaica. Canadians made up the third largest group, with 62,134 agricultural laborers participating. When it came to resolving the ways immigration control contributed to racial inequality facing people of Mexican heritage, however, Congress chose to exacerbate the problems. Between 1964 and 1975, policymakers drastically reduced the number of visas issued specifically to low-wage workers from Mexico. U.S. officials ended the Bracero program and imposed annual numerical limits on the immigrant visas issued to Mexicans. These changes in U.S. law did not alter the causes of migration, and millions of workers continued to migrate to fill millions of jobs in the United States. Eliminating hundreds of thousands of visas annually meant that even more Mexican immigrants lived in the United States without the right documents. Policymakers responded to the growing numbers of undocumented Mexicans by institutionalizing mass deportations as a regular enforcement policy. That decision turned out to be an important step in making deportability a cornerstone of the carceral state. Since the 1920s, Mexicans had been the top priority of immigration enforcement, but the numbers of people deported fluctuated. When employers needed a large supply of inexpensive laborers, immigration authorities responded by keeping deportation numbers low. At other times, in response to the demands of anti-immigrant sentiment, the number of Mexican immigrants deported increased dramatically. As the numbers of undocumented immigrants grew even larger after the new laws in 1965, immigration agents changed tack and made enforcement of deportability a regular objective. Between 1966 and 2011, the federal government voluntarily removed, or in today's nomenclature, returned over 41 million people. In the 1980s, policymakers added mass incarceration to their strategy of mass deportation of low-status, low-wage workers. Immigration agents stepped up criminal prosecutions of immigrants who reentered the country after deportation in what has been labeled high-consequence enforcement outcomes. Policymakers hoped that the prospect of time in federal prison would deter undocumented migration. Incarceration for reentry had a precedent in a 1929 federal law. A first-time unauthorized entry became a misdemeanor, and each reentry after that was a felony punishable by a 2 to 5 year prison term and a fine. But federal authorities rarely prosecuted the crime of reentry until the early 1990s, when political pressures increased in the context of immigration reform during the Clinton administration. The proportion of immigrants in federal custody rose dramatically as lawmakers prioritized prosecuting reentry. The federal immigrant inmate population swelled from 3.6% in 1980 to approximately 17.5% of all federal convictions in 1999, and further increased to 34.9% of all federal convictions in 2011. Most of the imprisoned immigrant men and women in federal prisons served time not for smuggling or violent crimes. Instead, 3/4 of all people in federal prisons for immigration-related crimes are sentenced for entering the United States without inspection or overstaying an immigrant visa. The federal prisons are filled with immigrants confined simply because they are deportable. The drive to prosecute the crime of reentry overwhelmingly applied to migrants from Latin America. In 2012, for example, a little over 88% of all immigrants sentenced for immigration-related crimes were Hispanic men. Several factors contributed to this figure. The continued large-scale migration of people from Latin America attracted to jobs in the United States, their deportability once in the United States, and the increased enforcement capacity of immigrant control. Over the previous century, immigration law made people from Latin America systemically deportable, and officials built an infrastructure to carry out mass deportations. To better police crimes of reentry, authorities expanded the system of immigration control in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. An important police enforcement program in this effort has been the Consequence Delivery System, in other words CDS, in operation since 2005. The set of policies, now known as CDS, limited voluntary removal and increased criminal prosecutions for immigrant violations in the U.S. states bordering Mexico. In the 1980s, then, policymakers transitioned from mass deportations of Mexicans to mass deportations of all Latin Americans with the addition of mass incarceration. Major changes to deportability for post-entry infractions were ushered in when state and local governments launched major anti-crime campaigns in the 1980s. In the name of more effectively fighting the war on drugs or the truancy of minors or homelessness, state lawmakers created harsher penalties for existing criminal offenses and created new ones. Prison populations exploded. The vast majority of the growing state prison and local jail populations were U.S. citizens, but the immigrant inmate population grew as well. In 1980, a little over 100,000 inmates were housed in state and county prisons, and approximately 8,000 of them were immigrants. By 2011, the total population of state prisons and local jails had ballooned to over 2.1 million. The population of foreign-born inmates grew to 124,026. Since more immigrants were in jail than ever before, many more were deportable for post-entry infractions after their prison sentences. In 1996, federal policymakers increased the number of deportations from state and local institutions by expanding the grounds for post-entry deportations. Congress created that year the new deportable category of aggravated felony. Crimes classified as such included felonies that involved drugs and firearms. The aggravated felonies category cast a far wider net than the older, vague category of moral turpitude. Since Congress built the aggravated felony to match efforts to extend the war on crime at the state and local level, the new deportable category had the effect of importing the priorities and targets of state and local law enforcement into federal immigration control. In the network of state and local prisons, anti-crime mandates and the massive deportability of low-wage workers combined to expand the reach of the carceral state. By 1999, for example, immigrants who entered the United States without the correct documents or entered without inspection totaled approximately 2/3 of all immigrants in state custody. As scholars have shown, state and local law enforcement efforts disproportionately targeted the poor, especially the racialized poor. Since deportability correlates to lower wages and poverty, undocumented immigrants, especially those racialized as non-white, became more vulnerable to arrest by local and state law enforcement. The large numbers of EWI populations in state and local jails is a consequence of merging the aggressive anti-crime mandate with the expansion of deportability of low-wage workers. As federal immigration control and anti-crime mandates merged, state and local officials called for unprecedented levels of involvement of federal immigration authorities in state and local prisons. In the early 1990s, California and Texas began to demand reimbursement from the federal government for the expenses of imprisoning EWI immigrants. State authorities argued that since this population was in the country without the right documents, federal authorities bore some responsibility for their imprisonment. The federal government assented in 1994 and sent reimbursements to the states totaling $130 million. Those reimbursements totaled $213 million in 2013. State governments also created infrastructure to expedite deportations directly from prisons in a process known as judicial removal. State and local prosecutors also now use deportation as part of plea bargains in criminal cases. State governments, therefore, tied the operations of their carceral institutions to federal immigration law and its apparatus in unprecedented ways. This far-reaching enforcement capacity not only helped support carceral institutions, but it also contributed to growing numbers of criminal status deportations. The responses of Congress to the attacks of September 11, 2001, and terrorism generally, heightened the national security dynamic of immigration enforcement. In its efforts to protect national security, Congress folded immigration enforcement into the Department of Homeland Security, which, in turn, expanded the jurisdiction of local and state officials in immigration enforcement. Since 2004, for example, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has trained more than 1,200 state and local officials to enforce immigration law. The budget for programs targeting criminal aliens also skyrocketed from around $23 million in 2004 to nearly $700 million in 2010. The addition of anti-terrorism to the list of the government's goals magnified its ability to carry out mass deportations and mass incarceration. Between 2009 and 2010 alone, the federal government deported over 2.5 million immigrants. Just over half of these were the voluntary type that immigration authorities publicly heralded during Operation Wetback of 1954. To process all the deportees, the federal government operates over 250 immigrant detention centers throughout the country. These numbers are one stark outcome of the merging of immigration control and mass incarceration. Deportability's role in the carceral state is now manifest in constant mass deportations and growing federal prison populations. Deportability also contributes to the staggering growth of state and local prison populations. Since the 1980s, deeply rooted ideas about illegal low-wage workers redeployed under the crime security nexus now serve as a cornerstone of the carceral state.
Next, we'll hear a poem written and performed by local Latinx poet and community organizer, Willie Palomo. A quick note to listeners, this piece does include mature language and content, including reference to sexual assault. If you're listening with children or anyone else who may be sensitive to this content, you may want to tune back in a few minutes.
Poem where mama teaches me to twerk. My mama got a big ol' nose, beak like a hungry pájaro, teeth like a mule, kicked piano as broken as her English. In pictures, she chooses not to smile con dientes unless we make her laugh, and mama's laughter can make machetes look dull, the way it guts a house of silence with its silver cut. Yeah, mama ain't much, but she got back. Latin woman, tu sabe, the way to carry the world tumbao, the way men and gringos look and think about you when they see a fat, brown ass, the weight of it cracking its lovely slit and snare, the bass drum, it pounds in the muscles. This is not a song where you can sit down and bop your head. This that sweat as a child in fields of sugar cane and cotton. This that slash coins made in her pockets selling tamales on the street with no place to sleep. This the man cornering her as she folds his wife's laundry. This him gripping her ass. This her no, Pero serendita, pero no soy tu estúpida. This the broken teeth of her knife trembling inches from his face. This is his laughter and fast hands, his threat to slit her throat and rape her. His chase, his boot kicking a dent into the thin metal door while she's trapped in his daughter's room. This is patience, faith, the 3 hours it takes for him to give up, get drunk. This is her escape to another family, another country, her song thousands of steps across the desert. When I say I got my mama's ass, I mean this. I'd come home past midnight to find mama's back bent over, mopping the floor and cooking pupusas after her double shift and at the same time. I mean, once I spent a summer day cleaning the house top to bottom, and when mama came home, she made me mop the ceiling. I mean, once a white woman asked how mama got that ass, and mama passed her a vacuum. I mean, I had never had to work a day of my life as hard as my mama. Mama can't dance, but the way she rocks it taught me how to hustle, surrender myself to the break, twerk.
Vengo en busca de respuestas con el manojo lleno y las venas abiertas. Vengo como un libro abierto, ansiosa de aprender la historia no contada de nuestros ancestros, con el viento que dejaron los abuelos y que vive en cada pensamiento de esta amada tierra, tierra.
Many communities in Indiana have become increasingly vocal about their support for the rights and safety of undocumented immigrants. One of these is a network of young organizers across the state called Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance, or IUYA. Their mission statement reads, "Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance is a youth-led community organization that seeks to empower young immigrants to achieve higher education, and with the support of our allies, demand more just and humane local, state, and federal policies that directly affect undocumented families in our community." You can find more information about their work on Facebook by searching Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance or at UndocuHoosier. Here in Bloomington, a student-led group called the UndocuHoosier Alliance has been engaged in similar work, encouraging the university and its community to stand up against violent law enforcement efforts aimed to target undocumented folks and individuals in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. They are currently leading an effort to have IU declared a sanctuary campus in solidarity with Movimiento Cosecha. You can also find them on Facebook by searching at UndocuHoosier Alliance.
This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message or share a story to be played on the air at 812-269-2517. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one. You can find previous episodes of KiteLine or more information on our stories at kitelineradio.noblogs.org. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across the prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. to hear more stories, news, and insights about Indiana's prison system and its impact on our communities. Thank you for listening.